So we're producing, we're producing five times the graduates, seven or eight times the diversity of the graduates that we had before. We're doing five times the research that we were doing before. We have 50 times the number of learners that we used to have connected to the university. All those things are the goals that we set out for the new American University. So the answer is yes, that's been built. And now it's that it's been built, now it can begin to have deeper and deeper impact. So
Dr. Michael Crow is an educator, science and technology policy scholar, and a higher education leader. He became the 16th president of Arizona State University, July 2002. And since then, he's spearheaded ASU's rapid and groundbreaking transformation into one of the world's best public research universities. As a model of the new American university, ASU simultaneously has demonstrated institutional excellence, inclusivity, representation of the ethnic and socioeconomic diversity of the United States, and a collaborative problem solver dedicated to consequential societal impact. They are lauded as one of the most radical redesigns in higher education. ASU is a student-centric, technologically enabled knowledge enterprise that tackles very complex global challenges through the focused lenses of sustainable economic competitiveness, social embeddedness, entrepreneurship, and global engagement. Now, he's decorated internationally, acknowledged expert on higher education. But what is really important to know is where he came from. It was from pretty humble beginnings, and it speaks to why his focus today is so heavy on expanding access to higher education as a vehicle not only for personal success, but societal progress and prosperity. I'd like you to welcome Dr. Crow. Welcome very much to our show.
Happy to be here, Paul. Look forward to it.
Thank you. All right. So here's what I'd like to ask first. So you are maybe one of the most capable leaders that I've ever met. I've been in politics for 30 or 40 years in Arizona. I've watched a lot of different people. I've also watched people across the country, been involved in presidential campaigns. And I've just, I just haven't seen people with the skill sets, the diverse skill set that you have. You could have selected a whole number of different careers, but you picked education. Tell me why. The others had to be more profitable. What was it that drove you into this?
The exciting thing for me, Paul, and I've had lots of opportunities to do lots of different things. And so the exciting thing for me was that I just as a kid, I became so enamored with what knowledge could do. If you understood something, what you could build. I began watching, you know, this, you'll laugh at this, but all these science fiction things when I was a kid about the, how the world could become a better place. And then when I was growing up, the Apollo 8 went up to circle the moon on the same day that I did my Eagle Scout service project with the family with dirt floors and no food and living in poverty in Southern Maryland. And I just became focused on from those days on how do you take knowledge and create these better outcomes. And then when I looked around, where do you create knowledge? Where do you store it and synthesize it? It just seemed to me that the university was the coolest place that you could possibly work. And then I got a job at one and stayed at one. And then I've been in this job for 20 years. I was the deputy provost at Columbia for 11 or 12 years before that. So 30 years in two jobs. Just constantly cranking out ways to create new knowledge to make the world a better place.
Okay, I know you also came from pretty humble beginnings. You did not come from a wealthy elite background. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, my parents were teenage runaways, and I was their product of their runaway. So we lived in public housing most of my life. We were a Section 8 eligible family for both public housing. I still salivate at Velveeta cheese because it's what came as the best cheese we had in the blocks of cheese. It wasn't called Velveeta. It was U.S. Department of Agriculture. We got powdered milk. We got government cheese, government peanut butter. And so, yeah, we didn't have a lot to work with.
That's amazing. All right. So before we get into some more meaty questions, if you were to think about maybe a kid that grew up in that same type of environment, maybe somebody who lives in Nebraska that's middle-aged or a middle-aged couple, they think that they're past the time that they could be educated. They're working in a job that they're not happy with. They don't have a college degree, maybe very little college. What would your recommendation be to them as it relates to public education or to education in general?
Yeah, the first thing I would do with those folks there that you're mentioning is I would say, what have you always wished that you could do or wished that you could learn about that you haven't had a chance to do that yet? And then I would say, well, you know what? You're lucky to be alive in 2022 because now you can do that. Now you can find a way to learn anything, anywhere, anytime, any scale. Most things are no cost. I mean, so the truly innovative universities like ASU have figured out how to lower all their force fields, make things available. So that couple living in rural Nebraska in their mid 40s, you never know. The husband wanted to focus in on writing, and the wife wanted to focus in on philosophy. You just never know. And all of that, even 10 years ago, this wasn't the case. 5 years ago, this wasn't the case. All of that is now available to someone. So their unrequited love of learning, which almost every person has, their unrequited love of learning can now be addressed. It can now be realized.
All right. You gave a speech, I think, yesterday to GPEC. Maybe it was to GPL. I can't remember which one. But you were up with other university professors. And you said something that stuck out to me, which was, based upon the idea of turn off CNN, turn off Fox News, turn off the social marketing. I know many people get their information from those types of networks. What were you trying to say, and what should people tune into? What should they be listening to?
Well, what's happening with those guys is that they're just finding massive financial returns in controversy and in argument and in negatives. And there's nothing wrong with controversy, arguments, or negatives, but there's something wrong with it if it's your only diet. So if your only diet is every place where we're arguing and every problem that we have, and there's no focus whatsoever on where do we agree, but only on where do we disagree, if you're only focused on where we disagree, then you're going to become a negatively motivated, argumentative individual incapable of seeing the blessings that we have been bestowed on us. You're incapable of seeing what you have. You're incapable of seeing what our democracy is really been able to achieve. And so I just say to people, if you're looking at CNN and Fox and that's where you're drawing your life's information from, that's a huge error. It turns out there are innumerable ways that the Center for the Future of Arizona has pinpointed 9 or 10 areas of shared public values where Arizonans believe in the future, want a really positive outcome relative to the environment, relative to jobs, relative to healthcare, relative to educational attainment, where 75, 80, 90% of the population are in agreement. These places spend no time talking about any of that. They also you can lose track. So while I'm very sad that, something bad has happened in New Jersey or something bad happened in Minnesota, thousands of miles away, I don't know why that's, there's a fire in Minnesota or there's a collapse of a bridge in New Jersey. That's important information, but it's not central to my shaping of my public emotionality or the emotionality of my identity. My personage. And so I'm all for people getting a little bit of information, finding places that just give the facts with a lot less argument, letting people make their own decisions about the facts and then trying to realize that there are a lot of places where we actually have common goals, common aspirations, and common things that we want to achieve.
Yeah, I watched Fox News not too long ago, and they made the comment that CNN hates America. And I think they're half right. I think CNN may hate half America, but Fox kind of hates the other half.
But even something like that, I mean, even that is it's on all of them. It's all about division now, and so. They've not thought about the consequences of their conduct. They've not thought about, that is the networks. They've not thought about the consequences of their greed. And so their numbers are off the charts. There's insufficient responsibility for also letting us know what's happening that's moving in the right direction.
Social marketing seems to be exacerbating that. Do you agree?
It does. It makes social media in particular. Social media is, this whole notion of anonymity. So you've got people saying anything that they want, so long as you don't know who they are. And so I'm like, well, why don't we just say you have to say who you are? You have to be accountable for what you say. And in social media, that would be a very powerful thing. You've got people threatening other people, attacking people, threatening people because of their ideas. Hey, let them say their idea. And so it's a mess right now, and it needs some serious attention.
All right. Ray Dalio wrote a book. You might have, I'm sure that you probably have read the Changing World Order that he just wrote.
Yeah.
One of the things, he pointed out a variety of things in the book, that some of which I disagreed with. He talked about how the United States is on a downward trend and China is on an upward trend, and he thinks that this is one of those cycles where the world power is going to shift. But what I did agree with him on, where he had three big solutions, and one of them was that we have to make more than we spend, that we have to innovate and we have to create, we have to create new product. The second one that he had that I thought was important is that we need to be nice to one another. We need to figure out how to work with one another. And the third one was that we need to deal with the inequity that exists in the United States. It seems to me that the role that you're playing, that what's happening in education, can really help on all three of those.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't agree with Ray Dalio that somehow America is collapsing and China is rising. What's happening is that we have maturation going on of global economies everywhere. We're moving from an impoverished planet where the majority of people live in abject poverty 200 years ago to a sort of a lower income planet, if there were other planets that we could compare ourselves with. And so what we have is the rise of now new industrial powers, the rise of global trade and global economic opportunity. And if it's managed correctly and fairly, and if rules are enforced with the Chinese and with others, we can probably make that work. But I do agree with his three solutions. It's innovate to optimize human potential, to optimize human happiness and to make things happen and to build our relationship with the planet that can be successful over time. And we're really big on that. We just opened our Global Futures Laboratory yesterday. We're calling it the Robin Melanie Walton Center for Planetary Health, the building itself. And then inside it is the Julie Wrigley Global Futures Laboratory and the College of Global Futures. And then this notion about being nice. I have no problem with people that have different philosophical, religious, or political views of mine. I live in the United States. I recognize them and honor them and protect other people's rights to political expression and religious freedom. And arguments against people because of those things are actually anti-democratic. And so in a true democracy, niceness would be one of the operational parameters that would be present everywhere. And so we at the university are unbelievably focused on freedom of speech and unbelievably focused on responsible behavior and unbelievably focused on making things work from an openness perspective. And then on this issue of inequities, the third one, it shouldn't be the case that your zip code or your family, your parents' income is the determiner of your life fate. It too much is. Your life fate should be determined by you, not by your parents' income, not by the kind of house that you grew up in. That just shouldn't be the case. And so that means we need great public education. We need great access to individual attainment. And so, yes, the university is about all those things. More and more innovations, more and more creativity, democratic engagement with respect, free speech, and tackling and attacking inequities in every possible way.
That's wonderful. I certainly agree on all three, but the freedom of speech issue, it seems to me like we're spending a lot of time on how to make people safe and not enough on how to make them strong. And you only get stronger when you're willing to face adversity, to face differing points of view, and learning how to deal with them peacefully.
Well, what's interesting is that, the Congress of the United States was designed as a mechanism to avoid ongoing civil war, to avoid conflict. And so it's a place for argument, It's a place for debate. It's a place for structured engagement and to make decisions across a polyglot, unbelievably diverse society. And so all of the arguments must be respectful. All of them must be respectful. All of the arguments must be built around the enforcement of rule of law and procedures and the way that things get done. And so we're just seeing a breakdown of that right now. I think that we'll return to a better pathway over time, but we're just seeing an unnecessary breakdown in civility.
I agree. All right. So on my way to getting a college degree, I instead became a father. So I had to go do classes at night. I actually was at ASU taking classes when I was mayor. I remember my political science class. I would sit in the very back of the class hoping that no one would recognize me. And the poli science teacher would always call out my name when he would come up with some theory, asking me if it was right, as if I knew. But in any event, it seems to me that the university is really beginning to address those types of students who don't all get their degree in a four-year period of time, and that technology maybe is playing a role in that as well.
Yeah, we've got so many ways now. So, Paul, if we were who we are now, and you were the teenager that had a young kid already, we would have lots of ways for you to move forward. Let's say you dropped out of high school. We now have a pathways program for you to earn your way into the university through advanced robot tutored courses that help you to get ready for the university. Let's say you and your girlfriend got pregnant when you were 16 and you didn't want to drop out of high school, but you had to take care of the kid and work, so you couldn't go to high school during the day. Well, we now have a complete online digital high school for you to go to that's all set up and ready to go. Let's say that you want to go to the university through the community college, no problem there. And so we have 250 degree programs that you automatically move into from the community college to ASU. That was never the case in the past. Let's say you want to travel around Europe and you end up, over there for 5 or 6 years and you don't even want to start college until you get back, but you have to have a job. So you work at Starbucks or some other company, but at Starbucks, if you work there, you graduate from ASU with no cost and no debt. So we've got that built into our deal with Starbucks. If you just want to come as a freshman to the university and you want to go really quickly, we have that. You can get your degree done in 3 years. You can get 3 degrees in 4 years. You can get your master's degree and 2 undergraduate degrees in 5 years. We've worked all that out. So we've shaken up the entire model using new intellectual designs, new technology that we've brought to bear, all these things. And we've got all that working now. So in fact, we just had our first online biochemistry major admitted to the Mayo Medical School, which is a very difficult medical school to get in. That particular person had children early, didn't go to college, wasn't able to go to college. Now that person's off to medical school.
Wow. All right. So I know all of this takes funding also. And one of the things that I saw in politics, there was always this right and the left. The left always wanted more money for education, but very little reforms. And then the right always wanted reforms, but they didn't want to have any more money to pay for it. Oftentimes they wanted less. Can you talk about how funding takes part in that? You've spoken about some of the reforms that you're doing, but other reforms that you might think to be important, not just in universities, but K-12 as well.
So at the university level, our big reform is we, the university, will fund the university. We've said this to the state. All we need the state to do is to fund students from Arizona to be able to have a lower cost to come to the university below our cost. And so what we've been hoping for a number of years is investment from the state in the individual students coming to the university at a very modest level. We haven't gotten there yet, but we have found new ways to fund the university. And so that's off and running. On the K-12 side, the error that we have in all of our systems of K-12 is accountability is missing. And so we've built our own public charter schools. We graduate nearly every person from those. Nearly every person that goes there then goes on to post-secondary. So we've proven the model that almost everyone, literally everyone, can graduate. But what we don't have in the K-12 model is the opportunity to actually create opportunities for leaders to run schools in the way that they could or should or ought to. We don't have metrics and accountability at the level that we could or should or ought to. And so what that does is it just perpetuates this constant argument, as you outlined it, you know, where the right wants one thing and the left wants another thing, and neither of those are right. Neither of those are correct, I should say. And so what we need is accountability. We need academic executives who are accountable for the outcomes of their schools, or they should be replaced. The same thing should be the case at the university. And we just don't have that. And so what we need is to stimulate innovation, set goals, hold people and make them accountable for the goals, accept failure never. People dropping out of high school is a failure. It's not a failure of the family. It's not a failure of the kid in most cases. It's a failure of the school itself. It's a failure of the system attempting to find a way to move that student through high school. And so what's been very helpful to us is that if we graduate under 99% of our students in our public charter high schools that we're running, we failed. That's a failure. And failure is not acceptable. So we've got to then adjust and adjust and adjust. And obviously we've got to build new systems, build new tools, build new technologies, make things happen in new ways. And many schools just don't, they just don't see things that way. They don't see that that's an accountability objective that they need to attain.
Yeah, it's amazing to me. I know that there are schools where literally the graduation rate was 30%. When you start to see that, you recognize the huge impact that that has on societies and neighborhoods and our community. All right, so 20 years ago, I think 21 years ago, you came to the university, if I have that
20,
timing
20.
Right. 20, okay. You talked about creating the new American university. I had the honor of being able to work with you when I was on the bond committee to try to help get a portion of ASU into downtown Phoenix. You have been maybe one of the most innovative leaders, I would say the most innovative leader when it came to universities, education, and for that matter, funding mechanisms and the development of our communities. Did you accomplish your goal? Did you create the new American university that you want? And how has that become a model to other places around the world?
So ASU is definitively a new model, new generation, new American university. And what we mean by new American university is that it is accessible, excellent, and impactful at the community level all at the same place, meaning unbelievably accessible to financial barriers have been greatly reduced or eliminated. We take every qualified student that meets the qualification standards. We grow with them. We evolve with them. We have a faculty that's equal to the faculty that I had, that I was a part of at Columbia, equal to the faculty at UCLA, equal to the faculty at the University of Washington, equal to the faculty at the University of Texas, meaning a world-class faculty, and then impactful, deeply impactful on our community by having an unbelievably diverse student body. So the answer is yes, we built that university. We are evolving that university rapidly. We now have 150,000 degree-seeking students. We used to have 45,000 when we started this process. So we're producing, wow. We're producing five times the graduates, seven or eight times the diversity of the graduates that we had before. We're doing five times the research that we were doing before. We have 50 times the number of learners that we used to have connected to the university. All those things are the goals that we set out for the new American university. So the answer is, yes, that's been built. And now it's been built, now it can begin to have deeper and deeper impact. So we built the digital high school. We built digital K-12. We built ways to train teachers in new ways. We built new ways to reach out to the community. We built new ways to help companies to be successful. We've built new ways for companies to train and educate their staff and their teams, adapting to all of the technological competitiveness that's out there. And so the answer is, yes, we've built that. Yes, it's moving forward. We've raised billions of dollars of private philanthropy to advance the model, tens of millions of dollars, $100 million just on new learning technologies. We have 300 technology partners in the learning technology space. We've spun out hundreds of companies in new technology spaces from the university, four academic campuses, six or seven innovation campuses. So the answer to the question of have we attained the design trajectory that we were trying to attain, the answer is yes.
All right. So I also know that you guys are helping power other universities through a private company. I found that to be exciting. Can you talk a little bit about that, what that means?
Well, so in the United States, we work with other universities and in partnerships. We have dozens of universities that we're working with, 60 universities that we're working with at a design level. And then globally, there's places all over the planet that they're trying to move their countries forward in new ways. So for instance, we have the new American University in Kiev, just getting started as the war was breaking out, is powered by ASU. Galala University in Egypt is powered by ASU. U Latina in Costa Rica is powered by ASU. So that means we're giving a relationship to them that connects to our technology, connects to our content, connects to things that we can help those universities to be successful, generates revenue for ASU to help us to advance the university here in Arizona. So the answer is yes, we're building universities and partnering with universities all over the world through a new company that we helped create called Sentana, which is a global university management and startup company for new universities around the world.
So on the on our ability to be able to be competitive globally on research and development, this is a question about, okay, we've done all this. Where are we going? Where do you see the future for us?
You know, so what's interesting is that I don't think that Arizona sits here in a place in time and space where we have an opportunity to build one of the most advanced economies that humans have ever built. So we are blessed with photons from the sun. We're blessed with water. We're blessed with beautiful space. We're blessed with unbelievable natural assets in the land. We've got excellent infrastructure. We have all these things going for us. And so what we're doing in our research enterprise is what we call the ASU Knowledge Enterprise. What we're doing is we're laying the foundation for a new economy. So we're working with the TSMC microchip manufacturing foundry that's being built. We're working with the expansion of Intel. We've grown into the largest engineering school in the country. We have an algae based energy technology company that's spun out in Gilbert. We have a water from the atmosphere acquisition company spun out in Scottsdale. We've got nano manufacturing companies in Tempe. We've got advanced materials, advanced medical devices in Phoenix and in Scottsdale and in Chandler. Unbelievable research activities going into carbon capture, the building of we have a spin out company in carbon capture. Carbon needs to be taken out of the atmosphere. We've got to balance the atmosphere. And, you know, it's bad that the carbon is there. It's an economic opportunity to take it out of the atmosphere and turn that into a business. And so we've been building the technologies that can do that. And so we're working on human capital development, labor development, workforce development. We're working on new technologies out of our research. We're also defending the country. People don't realize that universities are intimately involved in the defense of the country. We have a $17 million project working on nothing but the most advanced chip in the world that can both calculate a missile that needs to be able to think and decide things for itself and also communicate at light speed, all from the same chip. And so how do you build that? Well, they turned to ASU to build that. We've got 25 off-Earth space missions that we're a part of. On the Mars Perseverance rover, the big Z-cam on the top, that's an ASU instrument. The Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter going around the moon, mapping every section of the moon so we know where to go up there to build the bases and to get the hydrogen from the ice that's up there to build the fuels. All of that's ASU, that entire mission. And so we're involved in social science research and medical research and medical startup companies and spin out companies. We've got several pharmaceutical spin out companies in downtown Phoenix being incubated down there. So all of that is new in the last 20 years for ASU. And it's really, really exciting that Phoenix now has a research university equal to the one in Los Angeles, the two, equal to the one in Seattle, equal to the one in Austin, equal to the two that are in Chicago. And so Phoenix now has that, and we're very excited to have been able to build that.
All right. I know I only had you for a limited time, so this is going to be my last question for you.
Okay.
What is it that makes you optimistic about the United States? And do you think that China really is going to pass us specifically in the area of education and technology?
Well, the United States is the most unbelievable experiment in the gathering together of humans ever created. I mean, it is beyond belief. And we're only less than 250 years into this, 246 years this summer. from Declaration of Independence to now, that's nothing. And so we're a toddler learning how to walk, learning how to make it work. And look, the achievements of the United States are beyond belief. The embracing of diversity, the advancement of our of corrections against our errors, the movement of the country forward culturally, economically, philosophically, it's unbelievable. And China, you know, I've been to China a lot. The model there is not going to work. I mean, you have to give individuals liberty. If you can't give individuals liberty, the model doesn't work. So I suspect that they're in some sort of a transition modality. I mean, just 107 years ago, they were still a series of feudal states. And then they went through this unbelievable internal revolution and then communism and then state capitalism underpinned by communism. So what we've got to do with them is figure out how we can help them to evolve democratically, to give individuals personal liberty. And we do that by you know, setting up economic competitions where we can compete fairly against them. We do that by doing what we can in every possible way to be ready for conflict, but to avoid conflict. I'm always a big believer, you know, have you looked at the menu for conflicting with the United States? You don't want to pay any of those prices. I'm just telling you, those prices you don't want to pay. And so we need to get past thinking about China as some sort of rival that we're going to end up in lethal combat with, and start thinking about them of how do we get them to start playing fair in economic competition, and how do we help them to mature and to evolve. I mean, human beings need to be individually empowered. That is how we're going to achieve the success of our species. And that's not the path that they're on. That is the path that we're on. And it's a messy path, but it is the path. And we've made unbelievable progress. And so I am unbelievably excited about where we are in the United States. It's so much progress has been made. It's unbelievable.
Well, as an alum, I just would say you've made a number of us very proud of our university. From our standpoint, we hope you make it another 20 years. We'd love to see you.
No, I don't know. The body's an interesting thing. So far, so good.
All right, Michael. Hey, right. Thank you so much again. Thanks for being on The Optimistic American, and we'll catch up to you soon. Thank you.
All right, we'll see you, Paul. Thank you. Thanks a lot.